Picture this, a recording studio somewhere far, far away.
The Merry White House Experience. Phew, what a scorcher. In Britain this week, it was competition to see which could rise fastest, the temperature or interest rates.
A heatwave in Britain means two things. First, more than 48 hours of nice weather and there's a water shortage. And secondly, all the tabloid papers will print photographs of women sunbathing in Hyde Park. In fact, if you're in Hyde Park during a hot spell, you can spot the Daily Star photographer very easily. He's the only person still wearing a Mac.
Meanwhile, the Labour Party were busy discussing the policies which they hope will win them the next general election. Nigel Lawson's. House prices are visibly melting, as apparently are Sky Channel's satellite dishes.
These miracles of modern technology are falling to bits as a result of continued exposure to the sun. Ironic, since it was only continued exposure in the sun which persuaded people to buy them in the first place.
An expert was quoted in another paper as saying that the melting was nothing to do with heat. Instead, it's to do with exposure to daylight over a long period. For a piece of equipment designed to sit outside on a roof 365 days a year, this could be considered a drawback, although an inability to withstand daylight might explain why Norman Tebbit likes working for Sky Channel.
Dish owners are now being advised to put a plastic bag over them, although it's not clear whether this is to do with the heat or the embarrassment of owning one.
But the week's news was dominated by the row over the vicious tit-for-tat expulsion that has rocked the country. Matt and Luke finally expelled Craig from Gross. He was ordered to return to the Soviet Union after being found guilty of activities incompatible with his status, i.e. learning to play the bass.
Matt and Luke, quoted in the Daily Mirror, said, "We've always had showbiz in our blood, but Craig was always going to be a bank clerk or something."
This is a bit of an insult to Craig, and a huge insult to bank clerks. And Mrs. Thatcher was again criticising the European community this week, leading many to suspect that she suffers from xenophobia, or fear of Buddhism. One story from the week deserves closer examination. As the revolt of the Chinese students looks set to bring down the Peking government, word has reached us that students in this country are even now set to attempt a copycat revolution.
Okay, I call this NUS conference to order. Now, we're going to march on Parliament Square. 10,000 of us thrusting through London, led by Colin here.
Hi. Graham?
Yeah?
Sorry, I should have told you this before, but I've got a bit of an essay crisis on. Can't you lead it?
Oh, Colin, you know I've just split up with Wendy, and we were going out for 5 months. I mean, I can't handle this just now.
Excuse me. I'm disgusted with all this talk of marching and thrusting. It's so phallocentric. I'm going to lead a women-only march to the statue of Florence Nightingale in Stoke. I'd also like to say openly, I've got my period!
Okay, that's fine, that's valid.
I say we've got to get out there and smash and fight and kick over the statues.
Are you from the SWP?
No, the rugby club. I also think we should debag the bursa.
No, look, everyone, we have to take some concerted and unexpected action. So, this is the battle plan. First, we spend all our grant money on curry. Then, as one person, we catch non-specific urethritis. And finally, we all go out and buy the new Morrissey album. So, let's all meet outside the refectory, ready to march at the crack of dawn. Right, see you about 11:30 then.
In China, within 24 hours of Deng Xiaoping's rejection of their charter, 500,000 students were occupying Tiananmen Square. But in Britain, 5 months after conference, NUS issued an unequivocal message stating that they were still trying to get their shit together. Finally, two coachloads left Bradford Poly for Westminster.
What do we want?
Democracy.
When do we want it?
Well not before Thursday, because I'm meant to be rubber stamping hands at the Bop Against Boopa.
Hi, what sort of music do you like?
Oh, the Pixies, Household of the Sundays.
Have you got off with anyone yet?
Yeah, Kate 80, that's why her mouth's wonky.
Brian Hanrahan was on the scene.
Here in Parliament Square, I'm looking at what could well turn out to be the start of Waterloo Bridge. Meanwhile, just behind me, a crowd of some 30 angry students are at this moment pushing, shouting and yelling with just one purpose in mind, to get their faces on John Craven's News Round.
If you're one of those people, like me, that thought that a poodle was a doll made out of poo, then like me, you're probably a bit of a prat.
Hello, and tonight, to make a change from answering people's problems, I'm actually going to review a magazine, and I'd like to start with a charming monthly issue. Even more unpleasant than that charming monthly issue us girls know very well. Which goes under the very euphemistic title of Combat and Survival. It's a magazine for people interested in all aspects of the modern military. In other words, a bunch of brain-dead psychopaths. I think one way that you can define a magazine is to actually look first at its letters page. And surprisingly enough, many contributors had managed to string a sentence together. For example, Dear Combat and Survival, please can you include features on unarmed combat and knife fighting? The editor answers that they can't do an article on knife fighting as this could obviously be misused, unlike the whole page advert for knives or the article on commando daggers, I assume. Another letter says, please could we have more on personal administration in the field? Sounds a bit like executive relief of the penile kind, really, isn't it? I must say, actually, there wasn't much to interest women in this magazine. No articles on converting your handbag into a submachine gun. For those difficult days at the WI jumble sale. Or indeed, keeping your makeup intact on a 20-mile forced march. But there was a very fascinating article on lightweight stoves. And an equally informative article on the Ameli light machine gun from Spain. And the summing up of the gun's capability says, all things considered, the Ameli is a very capable and soldier-friendly squad auto weapon, well suited to a variety of duties on the modern battlefield. Well, I'm afraid I'm going to have to take issue with two phrases there. Soldier-friendly. How can a machine gun be soldier-friendly? I suppose it depends, A, which side you're on. Or perhaps the soldier who wrote it has rather odd friends who keep shooting him all the time. The second phrase I want to take issue with is suited to a variety of duties on the field. Now, let's not beat about the bush. I don't think they mean you can sling it over your shoulder and carry an old lady shopping with it, do they? I think perhaps a variety of duties means you can relieve a variety of people of a variety of their limbs. And for people who can actually read, my favourite bit this was, there was a charming advert for a specialist bookshop which stated, we can only show you a small selection of our books because the rest are too controversial. Now, some of the titles they did show were The Complete Guide to Lock Picking, The Joy of Cold Revenge, and Principles of the Quick Kill. Well, if these are the ones they can show, what are the ones they can't show? I'd imagine maybe completely mangling people for a laugh. How to break into a pensioner's electricity meter and then machete them. And acid bath body disposal. The 30-second challenge.
answered this.
And now, the Mary Whitehouse Experience Alternative Careers Guide, an A to Z of jobs to be avoided at all costs. We start with A. A is for advertising.
Never, ever think of going into advertising. For a start, they speak in a foreign language. When they say,
essentially, what I'm running up the flagpole here is the notion that the toilet cleanser market is a jungle, okay? And what you need to go with is a radical, animated, user-friendly, personified product which engages the consumer on a one-to-one basis.
They actually mean,
we're going to make an advert where a bottle of bog cleaner leaks around the room saying, Big Bad Dom.
Advertising people also use a lot of drugs. This is why, when asked to provide a suitable slogan to sell a well-established brand of Irish stout, they come up with,
it's not easy being a dolphin. Advertising is increasingly hamstrung by new regulations which are tending to make slogans less snappy. Adverts for financial institutions now tend to go, invest more wisely with the subject to status investments can go down as well as up members of Loutro Acme Building Society. Soon we will be seeing
8 out of 10 owners who expressed a preference in a random and strictly limited sample of a cross-representative collection of owners of small feline domesticated furry carnivorous quadrupeds prefer to invest more wisely with the Acme Building Society.
Increasingly, agencies are being called on to advertise things for no other reason than that government wants to privatise them. 10 years ago, the thought of TV commercials for water would have been utterly ridiculous. Sure enough, TV commercials for water are utterly ridiculous. Especially when you can't get the bloody stuff after 48 hours of nice weather.
This.
Mr. Robert De Niro.
What's the matter with you? You got no respect. Everything I do, it's not correct. Things are not so bad. It's a nicer place. Ah, shut up on your face.
Hello, everyone. We've now come in time for the Mark Thomas Experience. This is the bit where I discuss a topic of the week and then come amongst the audience and discuss the topic with you, get your views and opinions, and you sit there with loathing as I thrust the microphone into your face. Why has she caught my attention? This week was the FA Cup. There are a couple of things about the FA Cup that was sheer brilliant. And the first one was that they forced the royal family to watch it. Because they're sitting in the royal box going, is this polo? Where's the horses? I don't know. Where's the polo? But they're not actually sitting there, because all the crowd are going, yeah! And the royal family get carried away and they want to join in. They want to get up there and go, we are Windsors! We are Windsors! No one likes us! We don't care! They want to be up there and go, you're going to get your sardine head chopped off! Actually, the other thing that the royal family did, which is really what I wanted to talk about, was Princess Diana became a patron for the alcohol abuse agency Turning Point. I thought, who says she doesn't care for Princess Margaret? Sweet. As I said, my name is Mark Thomas. I'm going to come around and get your views and opinions on alcohol, which is what I wanted to talk about this week. Alcohol is a drug. It actually alters your body and the way you think and the way you feel and the way you perceive things. It kind of, if I'm at a party and I'm drunk, right, I lose my inhibitions, but I also lose my logic. So I'm sitting there. I want to tell this woman I really love her. I care for her. I want a deep, meaningful relationship where we grow to this beautiful thing. We're separate, but we're together. We're independent, and yet we're a unit. I want this beautiful, loving relationship. I'll end up licking peanuts at her cleavage. The amazing thing about alcohol, though, no matter how pissed you get, you'll still be able to remember your cash point card number. Yeah, sorry. Bleep, 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 bleep. But it is a drug. It is a drug. Right, just think of it this way, though. If alcohol is a drug and Allied Breweries are the biggest contributor to Tory funds, Margaret Thatcher's being kept in power by pushers. This huge, great big red Cadillac pulls up outside the Tory party headquarters with leopard skin seats. Yo, Margaret. Yo, $2,000. Boom. And the companies will sell anything. I'm sorry, we've got pethidine, that's off draft. I'm sorry about that. God, they will sell anything. We can go into a pub and go, I'll have half a lager and a packet of Phineas Fogg magic mushrooms, please. You could do it, they'd sell it. And the weirdest thing is the way they sell it. Like Punt and Dennis were talking about the advertising stuff, right? They are really weird because they tell you that if you drink, you'll be confident, you'll be cool, you'll be calm, you'll be able to play better snooker, you'll be able to play the saxophone, you'll be able to do all these things. They don't tell you that in 5 years' time your liver is going to look like Keith Richards' face. It's not your body, man. They come up to quite an interesting thing, though. Why do we actually drink? Why do we drink? Because it's like, most people drink, I think, for social reasons, which is a bit silly, because, like, alcohol and sociableness do not go together. The nearest I've been to sociable when I've been pissed is trying to get off with my best mate's partner. That's it. They just do not go together. The only people who need to drink for social reasons are Islamic fundamentalists. That is it. Oi, Ayatollah, come on, have a couple of drinks. Oi, girls, veils off, it's party time. Come on, here we go. 3 hours later, he's on the phone. Salman, I love you. I love you like a brother, Salman. I love you. It's Cat Stevens. I killed a bastard. God. That's the only person who needs to drink for social reasons. So I'm just going to come out and I'm going to grab a few views from the audience here. Oh, you'll do, actually. You're good. What, hang on. Let's get a few background notes here. First of all, what do you do?
Well, I'm a programmer.
You're a what?
I'm a computer programmer.
You're a computer programmer. I take it you drink very heavily, then.
I'm a computer programmer. No. Just give me another one.
Do you drink?
Not that much.
How much?
A couple of pints.
In when? What time scale? A couple of pints? I just drank a couple of pints once every millennium, you know.
When people buy them for me.
When people buy them for you. That's a sus, man. That's a sus, man. Let's have a look. We'll go along here. We'll ask you, because you're quite nattily dressed. What do you do?
Catering, chef.
Catering, chef.
I don't drink out of work, I drink in work.
Now we know why McDonald's are so shit. We actually have some... Actually, tonight we're quite lucky because we have some dignitaries from the BBC controlling board here. Oh, Ayatollah. Actually, you normally greet the BBC. You don't actually just go, hi, you know, to the BBC people. You normally go, when do you want your blowjob, sir?
Talking of XX String, we'd like to now bring you a group well known for that propensity. We're talking about the Pogues.
That's right.
For anybody listening at home who doesn't know who the Pogues are, I'll conjure up a vision. The Pogues are a teensy-weensy bit like Cliff Richards in The Shadows. Except they're always pissed.
You always get on stage wrecked, well and truly cut. Socious steaming bastard, right out of my nut. Locked and full and langered, in a brewer's droopy way. But if I forget the lyrics, I can always say, Turula rula 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 rye. Turula rula 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 rye. Fairly well, to my kidneys, my heart and my spleen. Put them in a plastic bag, you don't know where they've been. Fairly well, to my brain cells, they're frying down in hell. I've got cirrhosis of the liver in the morning. Give me Spinnix, Harp and Tenants, a wine bowl, Fred and White, a rum bucker and Bushmills, but serve them by the pint. There's three better drinkers in this world they call the West. That's in St. John and Jimmy Greaves and good old Georgie Best. People ask me, Shane, how much do you need? When you already sing like the Donners on speed. Fairly well to stomach lining, my bladder and my eyes, my bowels, they have emptied. Much to my surprise, I want another drink, but my ulcer, it says no. I've got cirrhosis of the liver in the morning. I've got total kidney failure without warning. Got cirrhosis of the liver in the morning.
It is strange that this month sees two 10th anniversaries. May 1979 saw the accession to power of Margaret Thatcher. 2 weeks later saw the birth of alternative comedy.
Alternative comedy was born at the same time as Thatcherism because most of the big comic names of the time voted Conservative. Indeed, many of them performed at the Tory conference, amongst them Jimmy Tarbuck. Although he apparently wasn't as funny as Norman Tebbit.
However, it is also exactly 10,000 years since the first joke, although it still crops up in BBC sitcoms.
There is evidence that Stone Age man had a sense of humour. Primitive cave paintings in central France have been found to have captions underneath. usually something like, if I don't catch this antelope, my missus will kill me. A cartoon recently rejected by The Sun as too sophisticated.
By the time we get to classical antiquity, humour was well established. In Athens, Aristophanes had a big success with The Frogs, which was basically a Greek version of Allo Allo. In Roman times, the highest honour a comic could get was an engagement at Caesar's palace, and at the Colosseum in Rome, improvisation became very popular with the highly successful Whose Lion Is It Anyway? In which Clive Anderson watched a panel of comedians get eaten by wild animals.
Already, even in the 1st century AD, the sick joke was very popular, and jokes followed great disasters just as they do today. Amongst favourites at the time were, what's the fastest animal on earth? A Mesopotamian with a luncheon voucher. Very funny to anyone who lived between the Tigris and the Euphrates in the 3rd century BC. Another favourite was, how many residents of Pompeii can you get in the back of a chariot? Answer, all of them if you've got a shovel.
Comedy then entered the Dark Ages. The Roman Empire declined and fell, and Attila the Hun and hordes of Goths and Visigoths pillaged throughout Europe. These terrifying hordes were noted for their cruel and violent sense of humour.
My dog's got no nose.
I know, I mutilated it. In Britain too, the Dark Ages produced cruder humour, and it was at this time that we have the earliest records of Bernard Manning, who shot to fame with his famous King Arthur is a Puff routine.
By the Middle Ages, things had changed. For one thing, the knights had joined forces with the barons to produce the Baron Knights.
This period also saw the rise of the court jester, who was allowed unprecedented license to criticise the monarch.
Yes, indeed. What about Henry VIII then, Jolly King Hal? What about Henry VIII gets fed up with his wives and chops their heads off? Now, I don't think that's very nice. Personally, that's just opinion. I don't think it's nice. Yes, indeed, ladies and gentlemen. What about thatch? What about thatch? What about thatch? Is it safe stuff to make cottage roofs out of, or is it just a little bit of a fire hazard?
We now come to Shakespeare. Shakespeare's comedy is legendary. The Bard, for example, invented the doctor-doctor joke.
Physician, physician. Physician, physician. I keep thinking I'm a pair of curtains.
Well, fie upon you for a Rhenish knave.
Well, that may not seem funny now, but it wasn't then either. Here's another classic from the Bard.
If faith, sirs, I wot you no tittle-tattle, but tis a spigot to a woodcock that my master wears the horns tonight. For by the sacred trousers of Jupiter, the man in the moon is a Gloucestershire capon, if tis not St. Glenda's feast. And upon my soul, may my nose transmogrify into a bull's pizzle, and let the Earl of Northumberland be thrice arrested as a child molester if my master wears not the horns, nay, and the trombones and string section too. For if faith, it is the horn indeed that besmirches him not, but Welkin's eye doth besmirch him for a poltroon and a right git at that. And remember, it's not always as you like it if you're waiting for an NHS bed. My name's Festay and good night.
The Mary Whitehouse Experience.
Now it's time for the punchline experience. Before the show, the studio audience were asked to come up with a punchline for this joke. Why were the Russian diplomats expelled? Now, we've collected the punchlines on bits of paper, which I have here in my hand, and the best ones will win a prize. Why were the Russian diplomats expelled? For secondary perestroiking. Yes, well, there's a cheer over there from the person who wrote that, and no one else was cheering, so that one goes to the bottom of the pile. And someone's just made a mess all over the chair as well. Why were the Russian diplomats expelled? Because in the world today, there are two fundamentally contradictory social systems which are mutually antagonistic, one based on the private ownership of the means of production and one on state ownership. Now, this carries on for about 5 pages. It's by Ken Bullman. He's got a B-plus in politics and an E-minus in humour. Why were the Russian diplomats expelled? Because they were hoping that Britain would exchange Pamela Bourdais in a tit-for-tat. Benny Hill's writers are in. Actually, that's from Petra and Sarah. I assume Petra's the dead dog from Blue Peter. Why were the Russian diplomats expelled? And someone's written, what's that? I don't know. It's a potato. It's all covered in mud. Ermintrout. I think we really are going to have to stop giving out ecstasy before the show. That one's just rubbish. I'm not reading it out. This is a good one. Why are the Russian diplomats expelled? Can you give Rob Newman my phone number, tar? She gets a shag later on, I don't know. It's not the prize, but never mind. Rob Lowe will be in there, no doubt. Why were the Russian diplomats expelled? For writing Morris Minor's Marvellous Motors. Good. Right, well, that's the end. What was the funniest one, everyone? Well, I wrote that one. What? Rob Newman's phone number. Yes, the prize goes to the woman who's going to shag Rob later on.
And now, once again, let's climb into the Volvo and wend our way past the freshly cut front lawns of suburbia down to number 19 Felicity Kendall Avenue for another episode of All Cozy at Home in the Family House.
Darling, could you get that machine out of the bedroom?
Oh, the chap in the shop said you'd love the new vibrator.
I'll get it.
Hello.
Ah. Father, it's the narrator.
Oh, no, don't tell me. It's going to get all post-structuralist and self-reflexive, isn't it?
For God's sake, don't offend him. You know what he can do.
I'm not frightened of him, sister. Now, look here. Just get back behind the revolving globe and remind viewers on BBC Two there's another chance to see the Embassy World Snooker Championships 1983.
Oh, I see. It's like that, is it? Trouble aplenty in the cosy household when Mother has a sudden inexplicable urge to look under her son's mattress.
No, hang on. Mother, where are you going?
I don't know. I just feel that I have to do some spring cleaning. Especially in your bedroom. There's a terrible smell in there, sort of a cross between Evo Stick, fish paste and yoghurt.
No, but wait a minute, I'll go and clear a few things out first.
More cosy calamity when both of son's legs break simultaneously.
Oh! Oh, you beastly man, we were going to play running around on our legs this afternoon.
Things hotting up in the house as daughter gets very angry, despite her heart condition.
What heart can...
Look, narrator, just you stop being so bloody childish.
Oh, yes, you're quite right. I'm sorry.
Right, now if you'll excuse me. Ah, at last I've got some privacy and peace, even if it is only in the smallest room in the house.
Yes, it's poo-poos aplenty as Pop goes flip-flop.
Get out!
Meanwhile, upstairs, Mother's just lifting up son's mattress.
Oh, my God. I can't believe it. This is disgusting. It's absolutely filthy. Grandmother must have been here for about 3 months.
Imagine Mrs. Cozy's surprise then when Grandmother's corpse wakes up and sings a medley of the greatest hits of Barry White.
My kind of wonderful, that's what you are.
Yes, thanks. Well, now, in that clip of classic TV comedy, I felt, and shoot me down, please do, that the play with narrative discourse was really pointing up the artifice of televisual reality. What do you think, Michael Ignatieff?
Yeah, well, as a tall, failed American writer, I think one important thing to observe is my great big Adam's apple going up and down my long neck.
That's a very, very interesting point of view, Michael. Yeah, Clive James, what's really uppermost in your mind?
Chicken, king prawns, truffles, and a huge pile of steaming mashed potato.
But about that programme, Clive?
Well, for me, no TV show has ever matched a galloping gourmet. I used to sit in the front row week after week disguised as a woman in the hope that Graham Kerr would run up and ask me to dine with him.
So, next week's edition of The Late Show is at the earliest...
Hang on, we haven't finished yet.
Oh, yes, you have. I'm bored out of my tree.
And pandemonium breaks loose as Michael Ignatieff becomes convinced of the fact that he is a short man.
I'll just walk under the table and go see Clive.
Ah!
And Clive James spontaneously combusts before he reaches the end of a bon mot.
They say that you only go to Paris once, but that you go...
So, join us next week for another edition of All Cozy at Home in the Family House.
You've been listening to The Mary Whitehouse Experience.
Excuse me, I'm the narrator.
Trouble aplenty for the cosy narrator when one of his testicles turns into a space hopper. It was written and performed by David Baddiel, Rob Newman, Steve Punt, Hugh Dennis, Mark Thomas, Joe Brand and Skid Video. The sound was by John Whitehall, the production assistant was Barbara Kerr and the producer was Bill Dare.